Chapter 74. She said,
"This is the tricky part. It's all about momentum now."
She turned the wheel hard to the left, and just as the front right-hand tire came down off the right-hand rail, she hit the gas, and the pulse of acceleration popped the front left-hand tire up over the left-hand rail. The whole car squirmed for a second, and she kept her foot light on the pedal, and the other wheels followed suit. 2, 3, 4, with separate squelching sounds. Sidewall rubber against steel. And then she stopped again and parked in the dirt, very close to and exactly parallel with the track. The first of the ballast stones were about 5 feet from my window. She said,
"I love this spot. No other way to get to it, because of the ditch. But it's worth the trouble. I come here quite often."
"At midnight?" I asked.
"Always," she said.
I turned and looked out the back window. I could see the road, more than 40 yards away, less than 50. At first, there was nothing happening. No traffic. Then a car flashed past, east to west, left to right, away from Kelham, toward town, moving fast. A big car, with lights on its roof and a shield on its door.
"Pellegrino," she said.
She was watching too now, right at my side. She said,
"He was probably holed up 100 yards away, and as soon as that last straggler passed him, he counted to 10 and hightailed it for home."
I said, "Butler was parked right at Kellum's gate."
"Yes, Butler is the one with a race on his hands, and our fate in his hands. As soon as he passes us, I guarantee we're alone in the world. This is a small town, Reacher, and I know where everyone is."
The clock in my head said 11:49. Butler's plight involved a complex calculation. He was 3 miles away and wouldn't hesitate to drive at 60, which meant he could be home in 3 minutes. But he couldn't start that 3-minute dash until the last straggler got at least within headlight range of Kelham. And that last straggler might be driving pretty slow at that point, having had a skinful of beer and having seen Pellegrino parked menacingly on the side of the road. My guess was Butler would be through in 11 minutes, which would be midnight exactly, and I said so.
"No, he'll have jumped the gun," Devereaux said. "The last 10 minutes have been fairly quiet. He'll have moved off the gate 5 minutes ago. That's my guess. He might not be far behind Pellegrino."
We watched the road. All quiet. I opened my door and got out of the car. I stepped right on the edge of the rail bed. The left-hand rail was no more than a yard away. It was gleaming in the moonlight. I figured the train was 10 miles south of us, passing through Marietta, maybe, right at that moment. Devereaux got out on her side, and we met behind the Caprice's trunk. 11:51, 9 minutes to go. We watched the road. All quiet. Devereaux stepped back around and opened a rear door. She checked the back seat. She said,
"Just in case, we might as well be ready."
"Too cramped," I said.
"You don't like doing it in cars?"
"They don't make them wide enough." She checked her watch. She said,
"We won't make it back to Toussaint's in time."
I said, "Let's do it right here, on the ground." She smiled, then wider.
"Sounds good to me," she said, "like Janice Chapman."
"If she did," I said. I took off my BDU jacket and spread it out on the weeds, as long and wide as it would go. We watched the road. All quiet. She took off her gun belt and stowed it on the rear seat of the car. 11:54. 6 minutes. I knelt down and put my ear on the rail. I heard a faint, metallic whisper, almost not there at all, the train 6 miles south. We watched the road. We saw a hint of a glow in the east. Headlights. Devereaux said,
"Good old Butler."
The glow grew brighter, and we heard rushing tires and a straining engine in the silence of the night. Then the glow changed to delineated beams, and the noise grew louder, and a second later, Butler's car flashed left to right in front of us and thwacked over the crossing without slowing down at all. He went airborne on the lee side and crashed back to earth with a yelp of rubber and a cloud of dust. Then he was gone. 4 minutes to go. We were neither refined nor elegant. We wrenched our shoes off and pulled our pants down and abandoned all adult sophistication in favor of pure animal instinct. Devereaux hit the deck and got comfortable on my jacket, and I went down right on top of her and propped myself up on my palms and watched for the glimmer of the train's headlight in the distance. Not there yet. 3 minutes to go. She wrapped her legs around my hips and we got going, fast and hard from the first moment, anxious, desperate, insanely energetic. She was gasping and panting and rolling her head from side to side and grabbing fistfuls of my T-shirt and hauling on it. Then we were kissing and breathing both at the same time, and then she was arching her back and grinding her head on the ground, straining her neck, opening her eyes, looking at the world behind her upside down. Then the ground began to shake. As before, just faintly at first, the same mild, constant tremor like the beginning of a distant earthquake. The stones in the rail bed next to us started to scratch and click. The rails themselves started to sing, humming and keening and whispering. The ties jumped and shuddered. The ballast stones crunched and hopped. The ground under my hands and knees danced with big bass shudders. I looked up and gasped and blinked and squinted and saw the distant headlight. 20 yards south of us, the old water tower started to shake, and its elephant's trunk started to sway. The ground beat on us from below. The rails screamed and howled. The train whistle blew, long and loud and forlorn. The warning bells at the crossing, 40 yards away, started to ring. The train kept on coming, unstoppable, still distant, still distant, then right next to us, then right on top of us, just as insanely massive as before, and just as impossibly loud, like the end of the world. The ground shook hard under us, and we bounced and bucketed whole inches in the air. A bow wave of air battered us. Then the locomotive flashed past, its giant wheels 5 feet from our faces, followed by the endless sequence of cars, all of them hammering, juddering, strobing in the moonlight. We clung together the whole long minute, 60 long seconds, deafened by the squealing metal, beaten numb by the throbbing ground, scoured by dust from the slipstream. Devereaux threw her head back under me and screamed soundlessly and jammed her head from side to side and beat on my back with her fists. And the train was gone. I turned my head and saw the cars rolling away from me into the distance at a steady 60 miles an hour. The wind dropped and the earthquake quieted down, first to gentle tremors again, and then to nothing at all, and the bells stopped dead, and the rails stopped hissing, and the nighttime silence came back. We rolled apart and lay on our backs in the weeds, panting, sweating, spent, deaf, completely overwhelmed by sensations internal and external. My jacket had gotten balled up and crumpled under us. My knees and hands were torn and scraped. I imagined Devereaux was in an even worse state. I turned my head to check and saw She had my Beretta in her hand.